You burn the body. Her name is Bethany, and she works as a clerk in the county court. She took the class when she was in college over 9 years ago. At the time, she thought she might go into forensics, but it never panned out. Working in a criminal courthouse was as close as she was going to get. Now she feeds her interest in crime through chat sites like Quora and listening to podcasts. The portal is open to faculty, students, and alumni. It has materials from classes going years back. They can be anything, from old tests to curriculum outlines to lecture videos. The portal has a search engine so students can look by class name, topic, teacher, anything really. As an alumna, Bethany has access to the portal. She says she uses it just to read the posts linked to this one class, but isn't sure who's posting them. She assumes it's the teacher. But really, it could be anyone with access, including former students. Bethany has a long list of gruesome crimes she is following on her podcasts. She says she never forgot that class and thinks about what she learned when she listens to the evidence used to track down criminals. She distracts the investigators longer than necessary. People get sucked in by stories of crime and criminals, career criminals, sociopathic criminals, everyday people criminals. Crime is inherently fascinating. Once they have the name of the class, they are able to search the portal for every entry posted under the class name. The last time it was held was 5 years ago. Since then, there have been 12 new entries. They are case studies, some pages long, with facts and news articles, but also an analysis of each crime and criminal, and of course, a detailed breakdown of the evidence. Just like they suspected, the materials tagged to this one class contain information that could be connected back to the shelter killing. First, the case from Colorado involving the pull rake. Takeaway: don't use your own computer to research your crime. Second, a case involving a dead baby found in a dumpster 27 years before the mother was finally found. There was no DNA at the time. Takeaway: never leave the body. Third, a case about a husband who killed his wife wearing a different size shoe. Takeaway: don't buy your supplies in person near your home. Fourth, the drug killing from 3 years ago at the hunting shelter with a room designed for dressing a kill, the floors covered with plastic sheeting, a cremation oven in the basement. Takeaway: kill where there's been other killing. The materials from the course itself include extensive notes about every piece of evidence a forensics team could find. It's both fascinating and disturbing to read, all told through the eyes of a criminal, a killer planning to kill. Bethany said it was awesome, that it was her favorite class in her 4 years at the school. This lightning strike does two things. First, it narrows the search for the killer. The tech department gathers IP addresses for anyone who has read all of the posts submitted for this class. Bethany is one of them, but she is easily eliminated. Second, it gives them a name, the professor who taught the class. She doesn't appear on the portal, not for the original class or the 12 subsequent entries. Bethany doesn't remember it, but the school has records. Detective Elise Sutton. The young man on the team puts the next piece together. Elise Sutton is the officer who took out the gunman at Nichols Depot, the cop who killed Clay Lucas. And wasn't Clay Lucas the patient at Clear Horizons, the place Laurel Hayes worked? Wasn't he the reason the cops down there thought she'd left town on her own? They make a call to their new friend, Sergeant Aaron Berg. They ask about his officer, Detective Elise Sutton. They tell him about her class and the posts she'd made to the portal since she stopped teaching, and how they link back to some pretty specific pieces of evidence they've found at the shelter. Berg is both alarmed and concerned. He tries to reach her, Detective Sutton, who's gone back on leave. He calls her cell. The tracker is off. He leaves a message with her husband. Has a unit stopped by her house. This isn't like her. He doesn't know what else to think, except that Elise Sutton has disappeared.
Chapter 25. The plan to find Wade by calling insurance companies and agencies takes longer than we expect. We assumed he worked as an agent because his alias, Wade Austin, worked at Shield Insurance, an agency. What we failed to consider was that he might work in a different sector of the industry. We get a lead from an agent outside of Hartford who says an employee at a small shop called Aster Life Insurance was fired a few months ago for sexual harassment. It's the 57th call we've made for this query, and Rowan reminds me of this as we drive north. 57 calls to insurance agencies looking for a tall male employee. 241 calls to courts, lawyers, and stations looking for a tall male stalker or abuser or con artist. He finishes the thought with an exasperated sigh. I know, I tell him. I gaze out the window and try to mask my anticipation. It feels explosive. We've already made a positive ID from a photo in his employment file. The 404 is an actuary named Brett Emery. Brett. No longer the 404 or Wade Austin. I try to replace him in my mind. Not just the name, but the entire image of him. The terrifying, terrified stalker. The ruthless, tall man. The liar. The predator. And now, the insurance actuary. Nearly 2 days have passed since he was in my house. Since he was in my bedroom while I took a shower. Since he left me a photo of a young man from under the bridge, a man I've now learned is named Billy Brannix after calling the rehab where Clay Lucas had met a guy named Nix. I've said nothing to Rowan about this. I'm too far down this road to turn back. I only told him about Mitch seeing Brianna. I knew Mitch might talk to him, so I covered myself. I didn't say how I knew, and he didn't ask. That was a landmine, and he knew to tread carefully around it. After I left the Lucas's home, I raced down this secret road faster than before. Brett's messages on the burner phone have a calm about them now, like he feels in control. He refers to the things he's done and to whatever he has planned next. Did you like the gift? I have another surprise for you. Are you back on the sofa? Is Mitch worried about the whore? Are you? The team monitoring my phone thinks he's gone silent. Dormant. There is a lightness at the station, like maybe he's moved on. Of course, we still need to find him after what he's done to me and to Vera Pratt in that dressing room stall. He could be a danger to others now, so we don't stop. But there is already talk about removing the detail from my house. Their road leads in the opposite direction from mine. Last night I sent the first reply. Message received. This pleased him, excited him. He wrote back seconds later, I'm glad you liked it. He couldn't help himself. The speed of the reply, the exclamation point, the interpretation of my ambiguous message. All of it gave away a clue about his state of mind and convinced me the road I was on had begun to yield results. My words could have meant anything, that I knew he could get to me anywhere. That he could get past the cops on the street and hide in my house, that he left the pink towel on the floor, or that he stood there watching me, naked in the shower, but then left me unharmed. Or the one he chose to believe, that I accepted his gift, the picture of the man who likely put the gun in Clay Lucas's hands. He could have given me the name, but instead he forced me to engage in my own investigation, one step behind him. He revealed himself further. It isn't rocket science, Elise. Yes, he'd found Billy Brannix before me. Thinking backward about why Clay went to the underpass in the first place, and he was right. We should have been smarter. I should have been smarter. You win, I wrote back. He answered with a smile emoji. The drive is almost 2 hours. Aster Life sells life insurance, as the name implies. Brett Emery worked as an actuary, making models that predict life expectancies and try to value policies. A woman named Georgina explains it to us as we sit in a small back office with four desks. She's our second stop, after HR. There are a lot of factors, Georgina tells us. She seems genuinely excited by her work. Age, gender, medical condition, medical history, family history, married, divorced, widowed. Did you know that men live longer when they're married, but for women it's the opposite? Georgina is attractive, well-dressed. Warmth radiates from her. She seems approachable, honest, kind, an empath. Rowan and I know the type and the psychology behind it. They are rarely suspects, and often victims. She continues, I used to joke with Brett when he asked me why I was still single. That was my response. You know, not wanting a husband to steal years from my life. It was a way of deflecting. Rowan leads our dance, getting the details from Georgina about the 2 years they worked together. Brett had been here longer, 11 years in total. He was hired right out of college, making him 32. He went to the University of Hartford, grew up nearby in Glastonbury. His parents are alive, but in a nursing home, as far as she knows, although she reminds us that he could have been lying. Men lie to her all the time about the oddest things on her dating apps, she says. And then she thinks a bit more and tells us she doubts it. He didn't seem like the lying type. He has an older sister who lives in Alaska now, a photographer, a free spirit. Georgina said she wondered how someone like that and someone like Brett came from the same parents. He is tightly wound, she says. Rowan gets every detail, how they spend their days compiling data and hunting down facts about customers, things they fail to disclose, like prescriptions for ED medication they got online, which could mean they have other problems like sleep apnea or alcohol abuse. Or maybe not. They have statistics for everything. Brett was very good at his job, meticulous, patient. He ran the department. And the department is just the four of you? I ask. Down to three now. They decided to cut costs, so they promoted someone from our team to replace Brett and then didn't fill his position. His name is Pete. Anyway, we may be small, but it's a small company, which makes every decision that much more important. She becomes defensive, so I shut up and let Rowan lead again.
So how did all of this start? He asks, the events that led to his termination.
Georgina looks at the floor, swivels back and forth in her chair.
I know this is difficult, Rowan says. Why don't you start by telling us how you came to work here?
We haven't told her why we're investigating her former boss, what interest we have in the man who sat 4 feet away from her in this back office, making models and predictions about people's lives. So she starts at the beginning, how she was hired after spending 3 years at an accounting firm downtown. Better pay and benefits, she tells us. Less stress because there really are no clients, just the company. No tax season to wreak havoc, no filings that could be missed throughout the year. It was a lot to worry about, and too much pressure. This seemed much more 9 to 5, you know? I look around the small, windowless room with the beige carpet and white walls and sterile desks, and picture Brett Emery barely fitting through the doorframe. I picture him towering from the seat of his standard-size office chair and having to slump to see his computer screen where he sat for 8 hours every day, crunching his numbers and searching for human defects that might make a policy more risky to underwrite. I picture him seeing Georgina with her bright white smile and alluring glow. I picture him smelling her perfume and hearing her bubbly voice and the desire creeping into his mind. As if I knew him well enough to picture him doing anything. One day it just started. Little innuendos that I laughed off. Like he was testing the waters, you know? Nice dress, he would say. Or, how was your weekend? Any hot dates? Then he would chuckle or wink, even. When I got coffee, he would join me and then keep us there, lingering in the break room, always asking me questions about my personal life. My friends, where I like to go out, what I like to do, how I kept so fit, and did I belong to a gym or do yoga or run? And each time I let something go, another thing would follow, slightly more personal. It felt like he was creating a file in his mind about me, like a mental database. He remembered everything I told him. And then he reflected it back. I say, yes, she says. How did you know? I shrug and lie. It's a type, that's all.
I think about the way he pulled me in so easily, effortlessly.
Rowan keeps it moving.
So what pushed it over the edge from flirtations around the coffee machine to the complaint filed with HR?
The report was sparse, which is common. It spoke of conduct that made Georgina uncomfortable and that was inappropriate under the circumstances. Always a caveat. The young man at HR there had been charmingly evasive. Georgina offers little more. She's been coached, and Rowan and I both see it. I just started to feel strange when I was here. Afraid to get coffee. Afraid to get lunch. Afraid to go to the ladies' room. I wanted to stay at my desk with Josh and Pete at their desks. They're the other guys who work in the department.
Josh and Pete. Are they at lunch? Rowan asks.
They should be back by 2. We only get an hour.
Rowan shoots me a look.
We need to follow up with them. See what they saw. Check all the boxes.
Were you afraid because he followed you when you did those things? Going for coffee, lunch, even to the bathroom?
She hesitates. We both catch it. Her eyes look away and she draws a quick breath.
Then she shakes it off, whatever it is she's not supposed to say.
I feel an urgency to reach inside her and pull out the truth, but I don't. I sit back and let Rowan work his magic.
First he gets up and closes the door. Next he turns off his phone and motions for me to do the same. It's just us now. What you say stays in this room, between the three of us.
But it's not that easy. There's nothing to say, really. Just what's in the report. What I told them in HR. They spoke to him twice and the behavior didn't change, so they fired him.
Rowan nods and smiles a little. That must have been awkward. Working in this small room, Brett right beside you, knowing you'd spoken to HR about his flirtations.
Georgina nods. Yeah.
How did he behave after that kind of public rejection?
The second hesitation gives her away. I decide to take the lead again. It's difficult when you see an otherwise good person doing something he shouldn't. I sense that you felt sorry for him. Now a long sigh. She closes her eyes and gets a curious look, like she's seeing something behind them. In all the time I knew him, he never dated anyone. He was awkward, insecure. It came from the inside, you know. He was a good-looking guy, great at his job. But it didn't matter. So, yeah, I did feel bad for him, but I just wanted him to stop. And then when he didn't, when I had to tell them a second time and he lost his job, I think it was just too much.
Now, Rowan, Georgina, what did he do after that?
I wasn't obligated to tell HR anything after he was terminated, she begins with a soft voice. It was done. He was gone. He moved away a few days later.
Rowan and I hold back our questions. We sit and wait and let her come to us with the answers we can tell she wants to reveal.
He did leave quietly that day, and I thought it was over. The guys took me for drinks after work to blow off some steam. I don't know what I thought, because he was always walking this line between good and bad, malignant and benign. There was a desperation about him, like he needed a win in his personal life, like he had a score to settle. I knew it was there. I should have been more careful.
She tells us then how she left the bar, drove to her apartment, and parked her car in the garage, and how Brett Emery was waiting for her in the shadows.
He came out of nowhere. Right when the elevator opened, I felt his hands on my shoulders, and he pushed me inside with him. I thought that was it, you know? I thought he was going to kill me. That's when I knew that my instincts had been right. Even when all he had done until then was follow me around, try to get close to me, that was my thought. Not that he wanted to yell at me or even try to, you know, be with me somehow. My thought was that he was going to kill me.
She describes her fear, how it must have been sitting inside her, waiting for a spark to set it on fire. We always want to see the good in people,
to believe in a world where there are no monsters. So much that we pretend they're not standing right in front of us. The assault lasted mere seconds. It was not sexual. He pinned her, then leaned down to see into her eyes. He was inches away from my face. I could feel his breath on my lips when he said the word.
What word did he say? Rowan asks now.
Georgina slumps back in her chair and crosses her legs and arms, folding into herself. Whore, she says, playing back the memory. He called me a whore. And then he started to laugh, like a little kid who's finally gotten the courage to do something naughty and then feels excited but also scared because he might get punished for it. Or, I say, looking at Rowan, scared because he wants to do it again. She tells us the rest. How he let her leave when the elevator reached her floor, and she ran to her apartment, scrambled for the keys in her purse, opened her door and got inside. How she locked it behind her, and then walked around, turning on lights and checking in closets and under the bed, checking for monsters. How she stood still and cried. We take turns asking more questions, like did she call the police or tell a friend or someone at the office? She says she told her sister, but then kept it to herself. She didn't want to provoke him. I stayed with a friend for a few days, made up a story about them having to redo my floors. But then I heard he'd moved. HR told me they got a request to send his last paycheck to a post office box. I drove by his house, and sure enough, a rental sign was outside. And he changed his phone number. There has been no contact since. I just want to forget about it. We finish with Georgina, offering our sympathy and encouraging her to file a report. Rowan gently reminds her that what happened was an act of violence, and she says she knows. Then she reminds us that these things happen to women all the time. We can't argue with her. She just wants to move on. The similarities between our stories are striking, and as terrible as it may be, this makes me feel better. I didn't create this monster. I didn't unearth what was hiding inside this man. His behavior that day at Nichols, how he first froze with fear but then followed Vera Pratt into that stall and threatened the life of her baby. The sudden violence is consistent with Georgina's assault, which happened before he even came to town. But then I think that it happened to me as well, on that back road. I had been the doe in the herd with the broken leg. Easy prey. The kind a predator doesn't even have to work for. The shooting had made me vulnerable. Rowan and I discuss our findings on the drive back after speaking with the two guys in the office, Josh and Pete, who painted the same portrait. Brett Emery was a geek, socially incompetent. Neither of them wanted to hang out with him after work. His jokes were off color, and he couldn't execute them. He was trying to be something he wasn't, someone people liked and wanted to be around. The more he tried, the further away he moved from these objectives.
I don't know, Rowan says. So he gets fired, and then what? Moves 2 hours away, creates a false identity? Maybe this was the last straw for him, this termination. Something cracked.
We get reports as we drive about his last known address near Hartford, now rented to someone else, his bank accounts, tax returns. He was a good boy. No late payments, meticulous in his money management. He'd saved quite a little war chest, which he'd withdrawn within days after his termination from Astor Life, and which had yet to show up in another account under his name. There were no hits on his social security number, no criminal arrests, no divorces, no marriages, no children. His credit score was 810, and he graduated college with a 3.8 GPA. The manager at the nursing home said he visited his parents twice a month and was always pleasant and polite. He visited them right before he left town, told them he was being transferred to a field office but would come see them as soon as he got back. He played by the rules, and yet there was something lurking. I read things off my phone as Rowan drives. Hartford PD is doing a canvass in his neighborhood, looking for contacts through his cell records, and they've got the plates for the truck. It's new. Registered 2 weeks after the move. He traded in a Prius.
That's a 180, Rowan comments.
There's no trace of Brett Emery after that. No transactions, no credit checks, which means no apartment leases.
He came here to disappear. And we know he wasn't using Wade Austin to do it. We already checked that. Probably used a different name before the shooting.
And listen to this, I tell him, getting a new report. He withdrew his entire savings account and his 401k. 200 grand in total. Withdrawn just after he left Hartford. About a month before the shooting.
Shit.
We both know what this means. Every case we've ever worked with a drained 401k, which incurs hefty penalties and taxes before retirement age, was done for one of two reasons. First, because of financial distress. And second, because the suspect did not plan to return to his former life. Brett Emery was not in financial distress. There's no profile here, I say. Nothing to understand why he didn't just run away after the shooting. He had all of that money. He could have moved to Mexico, lounged on a beach until we'd forgotten about him, bought fake documents, created a new identity. It makes no sense. I had been overly optimistic. I don't understand any of this. Rowan gets a curious look on his face, the one he makes when he can't believe what he's about to say. I watch and wait until finally he says it.
Landon.
Chapter 26. Dr. Landon meets us after his last patient. We've told him it's urgent, that it has to do with the Nichols shooting. I feel many things returning to his office. The last time I was here, I was counting down the minutes to get cleared for work and escape the numbness that had me in a state of despair. I hadn't yet followed the blue truck to a back road where I was assaulted, where I'd opened the door for this man, Brett Emery, to infiltrate my life. Now I sit quietly, fighting to keep my new secrets from showing. Rowan is quiet as well. He doesn't like shrinks. He says he spent enough time with them after his re-entry to civilian life, and not every pot should be stirred. Sometimes it just mucks everything up. Rowan keeps his demons at the bottom, like grains of sand that settle in the water. They sit there, perfectly still, letting the water glisten, crystal clear. But one shake, one stir, and they'll begin to rise. I know this about Rowan the way he knows things about me. Like maybe I need some alone time with Dr. Landon after we finish our official business. And he's probably right. But just like his grains of sand, I have my own pot I don't want stirred. I know the first thing Landon will ask if we're alone is whether I'd found peace with the shooting. I've already done too much lying. We sit in the waiting room while Landon finishes his last session. He has two doors so the patients leaving don't see the patients who are coming. Cops don't need other cops knowing they're having their heads examined. It erodes confidence, which is absurd, really, if you believe in head shrinking. Theoretically, then, every patient coming or going would feel safer knowing someone was sorting out their pots. But it doesn't work that way. Maybe we all just wonder if the person coming or going is crazier than we are.
You look tired, Rowan says.
Didn't sleep great. This is the truth, or part of it anyway. I don't say why I didn't sleep, that I was watching surveillance feed from four hotels.
Is Mitch at the house?
I nod. We're still tag-teaming in the afternoons. I'm usually the one to pick the girls up from school since we stopped letting them take the bus and stay with Kelly, but seeing Landon is important, so I asked Mitch to do it, and he didn't argue. I don't know what it means that we talk only of logistics in the investigation. I don't know what's left of our marriage, but I can't stop to find out. I tell myself I'm giving him space. I tell Mitch the same thing. I'm here if he wants to talk. But I'm not really anywhere but in the mind of Wade Austin. That name still won't leave me. Everyone else, including Mitch, thinks Wade has moved on. The door opens, and I take a deep breath when I see Dr. Landon's face. I return his smile with the exhale. We small talk as we settle into his office. I take a different chair than before and remind myself that I am not the patient today. Rowan manspreads, elbows on splayed knees, fists knotted together beneath his chin. His discomfort is comforting because misery loves company, and that's what we both are. Miserable with anticipation of our pots being stirred.
So, Dr. Landon begins, Interesting case.
The file we've given him contains a psychiatric evaluation of Brett Emery that the Hartford PD got from his parents. They were as helpful as they could be, as was his sister over the phone from Alaska. But none of them could believe that this gentle, kind son and brother could do any of the things that had been described to them. They agreed to let us monitor their phones, so we'll know if he tries to make contact. But he won't.
What's your take? Rowan asks. What's wrong with this guy?
Landon doesn't flinch, even though I can tell he wants to. Wrong is not a word he likes to use. There is no right or wrong with mental health. We haven't told him anything more. We want his impressions of Brett Emery before he walked into Nichols that day. The lack of context makes him reluctant to weigh in.
Without meeting this man or knowing more about him as an adult, my hands are somewhat tied. But he was physically different from the other kids throughout his childhood. He was in the 100th percentile for height and the 40th for weight. So tall and thin, Rowan says, to the point of standing out.
Landon nods.
Yes, he would have stood out. Add to that 12 relocations around the world starting in first grade and an extremely introverted personality, and you have a recipe for social alienation.
Why so many moves? Rowan asks.
It says his mother was a consultant. They followed her jobs.
And this social isolation. What did that do to him? Landon tilts his head left, then right, indicating his ambivalence.
In middle school, they had him evaluated for behavior that his parents described as reclusive. He had no friends that year after their latest move. It was bad timing. The whole grade was moving up from lower school, a hard transition to begin with. The kids who are at the top are suddenly at the bottom, and they search for ways to fit in, to find their social rank in this new environment. Brett Emery went into that situation not knowing a single kid.
So he was without friends and didn't know how to make them.
He stood out physically, Rowan says, growing impatient. That must have made him angry.
Landon nods, but again with the tilted head.
There is some indication that he had repressed anger. He expressed it only with his mother, which is very normal. Kids often feel safest showing feelings that scare them to a primary caregiver.
How did he express this anger? I ask now, as flashes of that day on the back road come and go. Wade's arms around my neck, his body slamming mine into the side of my car. I stop myself before any more come.
Look, Landon says, closing the file and leaning forward. The kid in this file had struggled with social interactions for most of his school life. It's likely that this was discussed at home, out of concern, but in a way that made him aware of the problem. He said in the evaluation that his parents were always pushing him to eat more, lift weights, be more outgoing. And his sister teased him. She had adapted to the lifestyle, moving into each new school with a successful strategy to make friends. Part of that was distancing herself from her awkward younger brother. It was survival for her. His home life and school life became part of a feedback loop, each one fueling the other.
Rowan leans back and lets out a sigh. This is not enough for him, or for me. Lots of kids were awkward in middle school. They were tall or short, pudgy or skinny. There were budding breasts and acne, body odor and periods and hair in new places. Everyone was changing at different rates and in different ways. Some bodies were graceful about it while others seemed tortured. And everyone knew kids who were introverted, geeky. They survived it. Landon senses his frustration.
You know, society underestimates the impact of chronic childhood trauma like your guy suffered. It doesn't have to be one big event. Sometimes it's the accumulation of smaller cuts that causes the deepest wound. It would help me to know what this boy grew up to become, he says. What he's done that now requires an understanding of his past.
Landon is right. I was hoping for a diagnosis, maybe like the one we had for Clay Lucas. Something to connect the dots more easily. I look at Rowan and nod, giving him my approval to tell the story of the tall man, Wade Austin, the 404, and now a geeky actuary named Brett Emery. He starts with the shooting, and the second the words leave his mouth, Dr. Landon looks at me.
The tall man? He asks, and I nod. And then he nods. Rowan tells him everything. What he did to Vera Pratt and the woman at his office, and how he was fired for sexual harassment, draining his bank accounts, and disappearing. Moving here, we think, shopping for pants at Nichols. And finally, his contact with me. The gifts and flowers, and then the meeting. The assault, going off the rails. Stalking me, my children, my husband's former lover. And now, seemingly, dormant. Rowan finishes with the last contact he knows about, the filming of my girls at their school, and then our failed attempt to lure him to the diner. How he mocked the entire department by paying a guy with a blue truck to drive through the parking lot. Landon looks straight at me. Is that the last thing? There's been no more contact? Rowan nods, and I do the same, trying not to let the blood rush into my face. It hits me now. Hard. I'm no longer just hiding, omitting facts. I'm actively lying. The sessions we had in this office just weeks ago come rushing back. The investigation into my emotional state following the shooting, which feels almost irrelevant now. The assessing of my stability, my sanity. Talk of trauma recovery and what it can do to a person who interrupts the process, skips the stages. And I wonder if I've gone completely mad. Because the thing about that, about losing your mind, is you're the one person incapable of seeing it. Okay, Landon says. This is the best I can do without observing Mr. Emery or speaking with him directly. So take it for what it's worth. He begins with shrink speak, the fragility of Brett Emery's ego from his childhood experiences, his ability to overcome them in college, at least academically. We have no information from anyone there. No professors who really noticed him. No friends who'd come forward. Still, had he been emotionally unstable, it is unlikely he could have concentrated on his classes and attained such a high GPA. And then, his success at work. 11 years with multiple promotions. There were hits on his phone records, numbers of people who saw him socially. Rowan relays this to Landon when he asks, and then he says this confirms his thoughts, which are that Brett Emery had found his place in the world. A job, enough friends to have human contact. His visits with his parents and demeanor with the staff at their nursing home, all of that indicated that the scars had either healed or he'd found a way to ignore them. The termination was a trigger, Landon says. No question. It tore down the life he'd managed to build. And all of the parts of him that he had come to see as positive were suddenly taken away. The assault on his coworker in the elevator at her apartment building, and then leaving town the extreme way that he did, indicate a mental break. Landon says he likely came here as an attempt to rebuild. He suspects he had a new fixation on a woman, whether she knew it or not. The problem was that he could never go back. Any attempt to rectify the past, clear his name, would risk being exposed for what he did to his coworker. I also suspect there were similar acts of aggression that were not reported, in college, with people he met outside of work. The behavior toward this last woman shows underlying predatory tendencies. And now? Rowan asks. Are they worse, these predatory tendencies? Yes, I think. He has become a predator, and I've been using myself as bait. I want to run from this room and Landon's eyes, which keep shifting to mine. Searching. He knows something's not right. There are likely two things at work here, Landon explains. First is the compromised person he was before. Essentially, he already had one piece of a common stalking profile, delusion. Your guy deluded himself about his coworker, ignoring her social cues, inventing a scenario where she was secretly in love with him. The delusion was necessary to his emotional stability, the image he had of himself that he needed to protect at all costs, even his job. And the second? Rowan asks. The second, he says, is the trauma from the shooting. There are stages of recovery that must occur before mental health can be restored. Not everyone can tolerate them. People move at different speeds. Some take years, finding ways to muddle through life without going through them. They aren't easy. Landon looks at me again. This time I turn away. The water churns in my pot, and I need it to stop. We spoke about trauma in our sessions. I taught trauma in my classes,
but now I've lived through it myself. I am suddenly agitated, impatient. I want to get back to my kitchen and the surveillance of the hotels. Landon rattles them off, and I can sense Rowan mirroring my feelings. He's been through all of this as well. Once you get to the other side, you don't want to think about it ever again. There are no victory laps, no finish line photos. Shock, denial, pain, guilt, anger, bargaining, depression. Then, finally, an upward swing to acceptance and hope.
Do you see the common factor? Landon asks.
Denial, he answers his own question. It's closely related to delusion. He pauses to let us catch up.
Your guy, Brett Emery, has used denial or delusion to prevent what will come if he faces the truth. Pain, guilt, anger, etc. The lingering childhood trauma, the acute trauma from the shooting. The causes are different, but the wounds are the same. And the power he feels from the stalking behavior is a kind of avoidance, a band-aid. Not unlike the way others use alcohol and drugs. Anything to avoid the painful process of recovery.
I tell myself to stay quiet, but I can't. I try to hide my concern behind a hypothetical. And if he comes back, continues his contact with me? Where does it end? How does it end? I look at Landon. Rowan looks at me. Landon, for the first time since I've known him, stares at his folded hands.
Given what he's been through, the extent of his denial, and the acquisition of these new skills and this new persona.
He pauses. So I finish his thought. He won't stop unless I make him. We take the elevator to our floor. We ride in silence, both of us thinking about this guy and, as Rowan finally says, how fucked up he might really be. If Landon is right, it's not just his past behavior leading up to the assault of his coworker and the attempt to reinvent himself. It was as if he was a faulty machine whose parts had been slowly wearing down, fraying and fracturing as he hobbled his way through life. A piece finally cracked up in Hartford, and then the whole damned thing broke apart that day in Nichols. So what is he now? He doesn't seem like a broken machine. He's managed to rebuild somehow. Stronger. Impenetrable. Landon would say that is all a facade. The armor of a sociopath is strong because underneath is a fragile, wounded child.
Fuck that, Rowan says finally. I don't care what he went through as a child or in high school. He needs to be locked up. Maybe some prison shrink can try to fix him.
But when we get back to our desk and sit down, Rowan leans forward and hangs his head.
I'm sorry. That was just so hard to hear. But it shouldn't be. It's just information about a suspect, a possible psychological profile. We use them all the time. I hate that I can't distance myself from this. I hate that it's become personal.
I nod. Yeah. Very personal. The secrets between us grow larger as we make our confessions. Here is my opening. My chance to tell him that I've lost my way more than he ever could, that I've gone beyond a momentary outburst to so many lies about all of the messages, the rented car, the plastic bag, the cameras at the hotels, and Nick's, Billy Brannick's. I come so damned close to telling him everything, but something nags at me. What this secret is now doing to me is nothing compared to what it would do to him. And that's what Wade wants. He wants Rowan to lose his shit, put his job at risk. I think about the message he sent with a picture of my partner at a bar, sitting alone, a beer and shot glass in front of him. I won't put him in that position. I changed the subject to Laurel Hayes, the missing woman who knew Clay Lucas. And we lose ourselves in a case that doesn't stir our pots. Chapter 27. It's past 11, and the girls are lost in their dreams. I hear the floorboards above me in the master bedroom, Mitch moving about. A shower, changing his clothes, trying to sleep, getting up. Maybe starting to come downstairs to the kitchen where I spend another night scanning the feed from the cameras at the hotels. With every day that passes, I fear Wade has moved on to a new location. But all of this is for nothing. I picture my husband stopping himself because with each night spent apart, the wall between us grows higher, just like the wall that now stands between me and my partner. I can't worry about this now. I have to find Wade. So I listen to the floorboards and drink more coffee and stare at people and cars coming and going in a parking lot and hope that the walls can be dismantled later, that it won't be too late. The phone buzzes, and it takes me a moment to process the sound. I've grown distracted, consumed by my every move, offensive moves and defensive moves. I've set up more security in the house, told Mitch it makes me feel better, even though Wade had gone quiet. He is still out there, I remind him. Door alarms and motion sensors. I've told the detail to be diligent about delivery trucks coming from either direction, to turn the car every hour or so to face the other way. They are confused by my alarm because they don't know that he got past them, that the messages continue even now that we've discovered his past. Don't think you know me just because you know my name. I see his unmistakable image through the steam, standing in my bedroom, and worry about ways he can get back inside, thinking he'll try again. I have my one lead, a plastic bag, but he's made a puzzle I can't solve, so I protect what matters most, my family. I open the message and stare at the screen. There's an image with an arrow, a play button. I can't tell what this is, a video or a live feed. I close my laptop and steady myself. The girls are asleep. Mitch is upstairs. No one's come or gone, and the image is somewhere outside. I press play, and the feed streams. In an instant, I'm on my feet, walking in circles, staring, wanting to scream. I grab my keys and run to the front door. The alarm chirps, and I hear Mitch call out, but I can't stop. The door locks behind me as I bound to my car. The detail sees me and watches my car speed away, but remain guarding my house because that's the protocol. My eyes shift from the road to the feed as I drive. Mitch calls, but I don't answer. He calls again and leaves a message. Then he stops. The cops on the detail call too, and I ignore them as well. I drive the residential streets at twice the speed limit, looking from the phone to the road. A man walks, the phone strapped to his chest. His hands are free. I can see one swinging with his gait. The other holds a baseball bat. Then comes a voice as he narrates his show. "He never should have set me up at the diner," it says. "He says." I know that voice, and hearing it again after so much has happened steals my breath. Wade. And look, now he's had a few too many. In front of him, another man walks on a street downtown. I recognize the buildings, a strip of bars and restaurants that fill up after the workday and thin out by 10 later on weekends. There are people between Wade and this man, but I know him as well, the other man in this new show. I look back to the road and call out his name as though he can somehow hear me. Rowan! I call his number, but he doesn't pick up. Rowan, look back! I scream again as I wait for his greeting to play. His messages are full, so I hang up and dial again. Rowan always answers. Always. I catch myself before I swerve across the line. I'm 10 minutes from downtown, from the street they're on. I dial again, hang up, dial again, and again. And then I understand why he doesn't answer. The people walking between Wade and Rowan shift to the right, and I can see Rowan's hand by his head holding the phone. He's on a call. His other hand waves in the air the way it does when he's arguing, making his case about something. I imagine he's on with a woman, and it could be about anything. A woman he stopped seeing. A woman who stopped seeing him. Maybe someone he was just with at a bar where he drank too much and now isn't thinking the way he needs to be. Complacency. Distraction. Damn it! He knows better. Rowan! I scream. I dial. I watch the road. I watch the feed. He's at his apartment. He stops at the entrance but doesn't go inside because he's still on his call. It's a walk-up, and he needs his key card for the front door. He searches his pockets with his free hand. Wade pauses. If he gets too close, Rowan will sense him. I stop at a light and stare at this image. Wade taps the bat against the cement, softly, just enough for me to hear the sound and understand the message it conveys. 5 steps, 1 swing, and Rowan will be dead. Rowan! I look both ways and run the light. Then I step on the gas as my vision blurs with tears. I'm 5 blocks away, but Wade is 5 steps. He's caught me off guard. This was supposed to be about me. Everything he did was to torment me. Wade came at me through my children and then Mitch. He'd been inside my home, watching me in the shower and leaving that package, which he knew would cause me to visit Clay's parents and suffer the pain of seeing what lived inside them. Now he's turned to Rowan. Another move I should have seen coming. I thought I'd protected him by keeping him in the dark. I thought Wade wanted to fuck with his head, make him compromise his work. Not this. Nothing like this. Wade takes a step closer and ducks into an alcove. I dial Rowan again. Drive faster. The lights are not sinking downtown, and each one turns red before I can get through it. I look back to the feed and see Rowan with his key card. He swipes it and gets inside, and the door closes behind him, locking. It's over. This is over. The light turns green, and I drive through the intersection, wiping my eyes, finding my breath. And then the voice comes again.
Don't go anywhere, Wade says.
I look back to the feed and see him walking. He stops at Rowan's apartment building and rests the bat against his legs. He's on the security camera for the building now. He'll be recorded. Even if he wears a cap and looks down, he won't be able to run from this. Everything else, the stalking and the images, is nothing compared to what he'll face if he goes inside that building and carries out this threat. I tell myself he won't do it. Just like the drive-by at the Ridgeway Shopping Center, this is an unforced error. The mistake he should have foreseen, thinking backward from the interrogation room where I picture him now. Because we will catch him. I will catch him. The car behind me honks. The light is green, so I drive through it and stop at the next one. I look back to the feed and see Wade's hand reach out toward the lock. He's holding a key card. He has a key card for Rowan's building. No! Now he's inside. He takes the stairs. Rowan lives on the 3rd floor. Another green light. Another red light. I call Rowan again, and again it goes to voicemail. Wade is up 1 flight. I drive. Another flight. I call.
Hey, partner. What's going on?
The sound of his voice takes over every sense, and I don't see the road. I don't see the light. I don't see the car coming through the intersection. Rowan! A horn blares, and I slam on my brakes. The other car swerves, missing me by mere feet. It stops, and a woman yells at me through an open window. She has a teenage girl with her. A daughter, maybe. Her right arm stretches across her in the passenger seat. You almost killed us! She catches her breath, then drives away, and I think, yes, I did. I almost ran right into you. I could have killed you. Both of you. What am I doing? This has to stop. It has to stop. I stare at the car as it disappears. Behind me are skid marks. The smell of burning rubber seeps through the vents. More horns blare because I'm blocking traffic, but I can't move. I can't even answer as Rowan asks me what's happening.
Are you in your car?
I look at the feed and see Wade back outside now, walking away from the building. If he's speaking, I can't hear because I'm on the call with Rowan. But the feed ends and a new message appears. A simple text.
Guess what comes next?
And then a still shot. It looks like an empty cafeteria.
Elise? Are you there?
I manage an answer. Yeah. Hold on. I pull over to the curb and put on my hazard lights. I expand the photo with my fingers until it grows larger, and then I see the small chairs and the gray speckled tables. It's at the school. He's been inside the girls' school.
Elise?
I'm here, I say. I'm about to tell him what's happened. I want to get out of my car and run to his building and see his face and know he's all right. I want to see him look at me like I'm crazy and then fill with rage when I reveal what's happened so I won't be alone with mine. My rage, and now a new fear because what comes next are the girls. He's been inside their school. In spite of the security, he's worked his way in through the employees in the cafeteria. But now he'll switch it up, won't he? Employees come and go through all different entrances. There's always a way around. Always. I reach for the door, but something stops me. I can't explain it, not even to myself. It's instinct. This is what Wade wants. This is what he's expecting me to do. Of course he didn't hurt Rowan. He would be on the security footage. The waning local media coverage we had now would escalate into national news. Every cop everywhere would be looking for him. He wouldn't be able to stroll in and out of a getaway inn, rent cars and vans, buy food and cell phones. He would have to disappear, and then the fun would be over. No, tonight was part of a larger plan.